Runaway Universe. Okay, so I think I'm keeping reasonable time here. I hope you're not getting too overwhelmed or bored by it. But what I want to talk about now, second last topic, is just to kind of focus a wee bit more on the big picture. So again, the kind of things we can talk about using the stars in the planetarium are the Andromeda Nebula that we've already used in talking about galaxies, and then one or two other objects that we'll get to in a moment. This is really all about Edwin Hubble and the work that came from Edwin Hubble's remarkable discovery that there were all these other galaxies out there, that the nebulae, as we call them, are not actually inside our galaxy, that they're outside. He was working at the Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena. This is the telescope. It was at the time the biggest in the world. This is the view from Mount Wilson looking to Los Angeles. So you think you've got light pollution problems in Glasgow. Nothing compared with there. So you can't really do much astronomy at Mount Wilson these days, but back in the 20s it was a lot better. And what Hubble was able to do was observe the Andromeda galaxy, and he was able to observe a certain type of star called a Cepheid. So the archetype for Cepheids is Delta Cephei, the fourth brightest star in Cepheus. I have hard trouble even finding Cepheus myself, but I know it's round about where Andromeda is. But, you know, it's a star that you could show people. And Delta Cephei is special because it pulsates. Actually, Polaris is also a Cepheid variable star. So, you know, it's a obviously very well-known one. So this is a kind of artist's impression of what we think is going on in a Cepheid. They're pulsating in and out. They're getting bigger and smaller. And the bigger the Cepheid is to begin with, the longer it takes to complete one cycle of pulsation. And that means that the brighter it is to begin with, the longer it takes to complete one cycle of pulsation. Now this is really, really, really useful because we don't know how bright the stars really are. We just know how bright they appear to be. But if you've got a way of working out how bright they should be, then you can work out how far away they are. You compare that with how bright they appear. So Cepheids, if you plot them like on this special diagram astronomers use called the color magnitude or Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, they're brighter than the Sun, but maybe 10,000 times brighter than the Sun. They're kind of yellowish-white stars, so they're like giant versions of the Sun, basically. And in the early 1900s, Henrietta Leavitt, she discovered a relationship between the brightness of Cepheids and how long it takes them to pulse in and out. And it's called the period luminosity relation. Now, the way she did it was by using Cepheids in the Magellanic Clouds. So these are visible in the southern hemisphere sky. You can see them in the dome. There's your Milky Way, large and small Magellanic Clouds. So she didn't really know how far away the Magellanic Clouds were, but she just knew that they were far away. So it's a bit like me asking, how far is it to Euston Station? And how far is it to King's Cross Station? Well, from here in Glasgow, probably just say like the same distance, 400 miles or thereabouts. But if you're in the middle of London and you're trying to decide which of those two stations to go to catch your train, and you've only got a few minutes to get there, then it's maybe going to be important which one is closer and which one is further. So the point is, for Henrietta Leavitt looking at Cepheids in the Large Magellanic Cloud, she didn't know how far away they were, but she could pretty much assume that they were all about the same distance away, because it's very far. So if they appeared to be different in brightness, it's because they really were different in brightness. Again, I've heard a number of you, and it's a very good thing to talk about in the planetarium shows, point out that what we see with the naked eye is some stars which are close by and some which are very far away. They might appear to be equally bright, but that's just because one is closer and not so intrinsically bright, and the other is very far away and much, much brighter. Now this might be ringing vague bells if any of you are fans of Father Ted, because, gotta show this, I don't know if you'll hear the dialogue so well without my speakers, but you all know it anyway. I've probably got the sound switched off, but we can probably all do it. He's saying, these are small, while the ones out there are far away. And of course, Dougal doesn't quite get it. But this is the essence of the astronomer's problem, that you're looking at stars or galaxies or whatever it might be, and you don't really know whether you're looking at something that's small and nearby or big and far away. faint and nearby, or bright and far away. So Cepheids provide a way to circumvent that problem. Effectively, what you're doing is you're using them as a distance indicator, or another word that people use is standard candle. It means that you can kind of assume that a Cepheid is like a 100 watt light bulb or a 50 watt light bulb, and then you can work out how far away it is. So Henrietta Leavitt set all that up. Hubble was able to take advantage of that and observe Cepheids in the Andromeda galaxy. And then that allowed him to work out its distance. He did the same in a whole bunch of other galaxies. And what he did next was use our old friend spectroscopy again, way back to the stuff we talked about with exoplanets, and he worked out that the galaxies generally were moving away from us. Now Andromeda isn't. Remember we said a wee while ago that it's actually coming towards us. That's because Andromeda's close enough to us that the gravity of the two galaxies together are sort of holding them together. If the Milky Way were about the size of central Glasgow, let's say the region inside the underground network, then Andromeda would be about the size of Edinburgh and about the same distance away. That's a fairly good rule of thumb. So Andromeda is a very near neighbour as galaxies go, and therefore the local gravity is strong enough that Andromeda is actually coming towards us. On the big scale, that's not how things are. And Hubble was able to observe galaxies on a much bigger scale than just Andromeda, measuring the distance. This is a wee short movie. Again, it's a wee bit fanciful, but it's just zooming through our own galaxy first and taking you on a journey to the cluster of galaxies in the constellation of Coma. So that's through some of the nebulae, clouds of gas in our own galaxy. You can see the spiral arm structure. We're going to zoom out. And then we're really going to speed up. And there's Andromeda. And then a few seconds later, we're going to head towards what's called the Coma Cluster. So Andromeda is about 2.5 million light years away, which is plenty far enough for anybody. But the Coma Cluster is more like 300 million light years away. So it's about 100 times further than the Andromeda Galaxy. And that's about as far as Edwin Hubble was able to go to measure distances. So by getting that far out, what he was able to do was to work out how far away the galaxies were, and also whether the galaxies were moving away or coming towards us. And he found that, quite amazingly, that they all seemed to be moving away, with the notable exception of Andromeda and one or two really nearby ones. The pattern seemed to be that the further away you went, the more the galaxies were moving away. So, what does this mean? Well, we've had 90 years to get our heads around it, and it's still pretty stunning. What we think it means is that the universe is actually expanding, and really, the kind of theoretical underpinning is down to Albert Einstein again, thinking about the way that gravity works. Essentially, gravity bends the geometry, the shape of space and time. And if you've got an event like the Big Bang that starts it all off, then actually what that would do is stretch space-time to make space-time itself expand. So the conventional analogy we use is to think of a surface of a balloon. And the wee squiggles are to represent light. And as light is carried around the surface of the balloon between one galaxy and another, it will be shifted towards longer or redder wavelengths by the expansion. So, I'm not necessarily recommending that you try and bolt all of that into a talk about the sky tonight, but I guess what it's rooted in is the fundamental big discovery that Andromeda lies outside of our own galaxy, and that was made possible because of the kind of getting round the Father Ted problem, or the Father Dougal problem more to the point, that we could make the distinction between things which were small and nearby and large and far away. The kind of things you'll probably get questions about, how does this all fit into the very latest discoveries? Well, the Hubble Space Telescope, named after Hubble, over the course of about 10 years, studied these Cepheid variables in a whole bunch of other galaxies. Not just Andromeda, which Hubble had done, but pushing out towards the Coma Cluster and beyond. And many of them are really beautiful. They're grand design spirals, just like the Milky Way. And what HST set out to do was to link the Cepheids to other methods of measuring distance, other standard candles. And probably the most well-known is another type of supernova. It's called a Type 1A supernova. And we think it's a binary, two stars, a red giant star, remember that's the thing the sun's going to turn into, orbiting a white dwarf, another thing that the sun's going to turn into, but the outside bit's already drifted off. And what the red giant's doing is it's kind of feeding material onto the white dwarf, just like we talked about for black holes as well. And eventually what may happen is that it pushes the white dwarf over the limit that it's allowed to be. You know, it can only be so massive, and if it's any more massive than that, it becomes unstable. It blows itself up, and it blows itself up as a Type 1A supernova. So Type 1A supernovae are really bright explosions, just like the other sort of supernovae that we talked about before, the core collapse ones, and they can be seen very far away. In fact, for a brief time, they can outshine an entire galaxy. I know it doesn't look like much, but that's a galaxy, 100,000 million stars or thereabouts. That's a single star, and for a few weeks, it was, you know, outshining the whole galaxy. This is quite old now, 1998, but these observations were really important because what they did was they helped to convince us that the universe was doing something completely unexpected. We expected that the universe ought to be expanding, thanks to Einstein and then Hubble's observations, but we expected it ought to be slowing down. Just like if I take this pound coin and throw it in the air, it goes up, but it slows down as it goes up, and then it speeds up as it comes down. It would look pretty weird if I threw the coin in the air and the higher it went, the faster it went. But that's what we think the universe is doing. Moreover, we actually now are pretty sure that a long time ago the universe was slowing down. It's just in the last few billion years that it started to speed up. We don't know why. We really, really don't know why. But the observation that the universe is speeding up is now seen as pretty solid. So solid, in fact, that this year, the Nobel Prize for Physics was awarded to the people that first observed it. And my minor claim to fame, well, I know all three of these people, but about 14 months ago, I was playing Ultimate Frisbee on a beach in Australia with Brian Schmidt, one of the three, and he never gave a hint that it was even in the pipeline. But I guess we all thought that one of these days they would get the Nobel Prize for it because it was such a remarkable discovery. So we think the universe is speeding up. We don't know why, but we've given it a cool name. We call it dark energy. What is dark energy? We really don't know, but think of it as like anti-gravity. It's like something which is basically pushing space apart instead of trying to pull space together, which gravity would do. And right now, we think that what's happening is that dark energy is winning the kind of tug of war with all the matter in the universe, including some that we can't see called dark matter that we think is there, but we don't really know what that is either, so it's all kind of embarrassing, really. We only think we know what about 4% of the matter and energy in the universe is. We can tell that the rest is there, but we don't know what it is. So all the atoms that make up us is about 4.5%. The dark matter is about 23%, and the dark energy about 72%. So about 96% of the universe is weird stuff that we're pretty sure is there. We know kind of what it does, but we don't know what it is. And if that sounds unsatisfactory, well, it's kind of a consequence of the way that gravity works, because again, if I take my pound coin, and this time I take my keys, if I drop them, they both hit the ground at the same time. Well, if I drop them at the same time, they will. Try that one again. So the point is, how they move doesn't tell you anything about what they're made of. It can tell you how much there is, at least if you make measurements which are sensitive enough, but it fundamentally doesn't tell you what they're made of. And that's the problem we face with dark matter and dark energy. We can see the effect that dark matter and dark energy has on the expansion of the universe and making the supernovae appear a certain distance away, but it doesn't really tell us what dark matter and dark energy are. Okay? And I think again, it maybe wouldn't work when you're in the middle of a show in here, but, you know, insofar as these topics could be covered out there in the Science Mall, throwing coins in the air and all that kind of stuff, that's what I would do. You know, bring it down to sort of down-to-earth, everyday experience. And just to emphasise that this is weird, that this is different from what your common sense would predict.
Can you just clarify the difference between dark matter and dark energy?
Sure. Absolutely. We don't know what dark matter is, but the best candidate is some kind of elementary particle, which means it's not a neutron, it's not a proton, it's not an electron, but it's something else which surrounds and fills galaxies and the space between galaxies and has fundamentally the same property as all the other matter that we do understand a bit better, that it attracts other matter. Okay? So the presence of all of that dark matter in the early universe was trying to pull the universe back together. Unfortunately not succeeding, well maybe fortunately from our point of view, because we would never have existed if it had. What's changed in the last few billion years is that the dark energy, which has the opposite effect, almost like anti-gravity, has overtaken the dark matter. So now instead of the universe slowing down, at least the dark matter was trying to pull things back together, well now the dark energy is succeeding in pushing it apart. Okay? But if you're looking for a better explanation of what dark matter and dark energy is, well, we don't really have one. See, the best we can do with dark matter, at least, is to say, well, some kind of elementary particle, it would be easy to imagine that the universe is filled with a lot of that stuff, and it doesn't really interact with anything much. It doesn't, like, you know, shine. It doesn't produce chemicals or nuclear radiation. It just has gravity. That's our best guess. But dark energy is even weirder. But the thing we're stuck with is this observation that the universe really is speeding up. Well, we've got to explain it somehow. And a kind of an energy field which has, well, what we call negative pressure, which again just acts as an outward pushing force, is our best guess. Now, the problem with going down that road in terms of an analogy is that actually we're accustomed to thinking in good old simple Isaac Newton's type of science, that pressure, even when it's positive, is an outward force, because that's exactly what I said when we were talking about stars, that the pressure pushes out and the matter, the gravity, tries to pull in. So the reality is that there's like normal pressure and there's weird pressure. So in some ways I just try to avoid getting too much into these analogies, because obviously, I would say this, but it's true. It's not that I don't understand it myself. I mean, I understand it well enough to get myself out of a hole, but it's just generally not a good idea to dig yourself into the hole in the first place. So, I think this is one where a very light touch is required. And if I were you, the best thing you can do if you want to engage with this kind of stuff is to use it as a way of emphasising that there's a whole lot of stuff we don't know, and that's why we need a new generation of scientists. This is not an example where we can say proudly, hey, we've worked it all out. This is an example of where even the best brains on the planet don't know what dark energy is. So you can say to your audience, maybe one of you will solve it. And that's kind of the approach we're taking with the higher and advanced higher as well. There's content about these topics in there, but we're not trying to put it on an equal footing with Newton's laws that have been tried and tested for hundreds of years. We're putting it in there as an indication that the subject is still evolving and we're still learning, and in fact there's probably more questions than there are answers. So I wouldn't be afraid to mention it, but don't over-egg what we know, because again, you know, the programmes like Brian Cox's one or Jim Al-Khalili's have tried to take the same line. They've taken the line, there's an awful lot we don't understand about this. Okay?